This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
All right. Good evening, everybody. Today on Beat Your Genes, we are going to be going over some emails, some questions, some listener questions, some comments. We are joined by Dr. Doug Lyle, as always. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing today?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How is the audio on our end here?
It's good on your end so far. So far, so good.
So far, so good. Yeah. Hopefully, you can get it for a couple of minutes. So.
Yeah.
Well, over the last couple of weeks, we have had a great number of emails from different listeners here and there, and I always love listening, reading these emails because I just want to thank you listeners here. This is our one-year anniversary, so 52 weeks ago, we did the show, we started the show, and so far, we are just powering through, having a good time. I'm having a great time listening to you, Dr. Lyle. So are all the listeners, so we really want to thank the listeners for joining us.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to do this.
It's always a good time. And so with our listeners, I get all your questions. I read all the emails and I do my best to categorize them and just kind of get a list. And we just get to the ones that we get to as soon as we can. And if anybody wants, has a burning question you really want to get to it, feel free to call us during the show and we can go over it right then and there. So without too much delay, let's just get right to it. We've got a few questions here today.
Excellent.
Ready, Dr. Lyle?
I'm ready.
This is a deep one, so I might not understand your answer here, but some listeners probably will. Okay, here we go. Dear Dr. Lyle, I hear you talk about the various neural networks in the brain, such as the sociometer, the esteem meter, as well as circuits relating to measuring attractiveness and expressing emotions like anger. Modern brain imaging suggests that there are about 200 specialized brain regions. Can you outline how many of these circuits related to social interactions exist in the human brain and what their functions are? I'm looking for a high level of understanding of the number and function of such circuits. Thank you.
I think we're talking to an electrical engineer.
I promise that wasn't my question.
That's right. I forgot you were an electrical engineer. The it's a very good question in a lot of ways, and first of all, the answer is nobody really has any idea how many specialized neural circuits there are in the brain. I did not know that brain imaging studies suggest that there's about 200 specialized brain regions. I think that I'm not even sure what that means. So if you go into simply the hypothalamus all by itself, you will find that the hypothalamus is regulating sleep, it's regulating food intake, it's regulating water, it's regulating temperature. That thing alone is regulating all kinds of different things. So there may be 200 regions that somehow show up on a brain imaging that suggest clusters of interrelated neural circuits. But the amount of neural circuits that are specialized and built into the human mind undoubtedly reaches the many, many thousands of specialized circuits. It's kind of I've never studied much physiology, but I am aware that if you're a hand surgeon, for example, and you start going into the hand, there's a, this tendon and a that tendon, and there's a little tendon that attaches to the other tendon, et cetera. There, in other words, there's an architecture, even though there's a significant amount of individual variation in the various pieces and their size and their angles of origin and insertion and so forth. But the truth is that if you get in there, even though you're going to see some individual variation, there's a tremendous amount of essentially of identical architecture. And so this is really what the questioner is asking. Like, essentially, how many different specialized neural circuits make up the psychological architecture of a human? And that's a very good question. And I would hazard a guess. My guess is, maybe 10,000. And I only say that not because it's possible there's less. It's possible it's 3,000. I don't think so. I think there's at least 10,000 specialized circuits, and then a lot of behavior can be so the behavior of this organism is essentially the combination of the timing and the firing of 10,000 different circuits. Could potentially give rise to as complicated a being as a human. Maybe not. Along with those circuits, you have additional circuits that involve holding information or learning that essentially feed data into the existing circuits. So it gets tremendously complicated. But I think the answer is I don't know that we're even going to have a fairly decent guess about the answer to this question for at least 100 years. So don't hold your breath.
Yeah. Well, maybe if there's a neurosurgeon might be I was wondering if any of our listeners might be a neurologist, neurosurgeon.
Yeah, neurosurgeon wouldn't have a clue. The neurosurgeon, they're just trained in, go get that tumor right there and do as little damage as possible. They don't really know anything about what we're talking about here. The what we're talking about here is there is a neural architecture that gives rise to what you're going to call human psychology. So somewhere in this brain, there is a way to activate, for example, a humor reflex, and it's going to be complicated as hell. Because there's probably going to be more than one set type of stimuli that can activate it. I believe that all humor, I believe, is going to be activated through the mechanisms of the reduction of status on the part of somebody. So it may be you yourself, it may be someone else. In other words, but when you listen to a comic, what you're listening to is you're listening to them essentially talk through a situation that you imagine or one that they're acting out right in front of you where somebody is losing status. I don't believe now in the 30 years that I've been thinking about this, I don't believe I've ever come across something funny where somebody wasn't theoretically losing status somewhere. That might have been a cat or a dog losing status. But somewhere, somebody is actually being made fun of. And so that circuit, you can imagine how sophisticated and extraordinary it would take to, and it's incidentally, this is a great example of how you don't learn to be a human. You just are. In the same way, you don't learn to be an aardvark and you don't learn to be a shark. Part of being a human is that you are born with neural circuits that when certain social processes take place of which you are unbelievably attuned to, and you are very much attuned to the processes by which people lose and gain status. And you are aware that when people that you don't like lose status, that's legitimately funny and satisfying. And it's also true that when people that you like lose status, but they don't lose real status, they are actually losing what I call faux status. So it's not really hurting their status. then that's also enjoyable. Okay, so it is not so enjoyable when someone that you don't like loses faux status. That's not particularly great. What's great is when they lose real status. And so this clearly was a set of neural circuits that was designed to both enjoy the process of having our competitors lose status, as well as generate commentary by which that could happen. And so by being able to, you need to be able to enjoy it to be able to generate it. And so we're going to be designed to be scheming to try to figure out how to make fun of competitors and to have them lose some status in order to elevate our own mating prospects. And so this is a very interesting and important set of circuits inside of human nature. But just as I talk about this, I think you could start to imagine what a sophisticated set of circuits that would have to be.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's tremendous. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was saying, speaking of humor and status and losing status, we had an email from one of the listeners a couple of days ago who was trying to ask how to be more funny for a business presentation. So she's actually on hold right now.
Right.
So she called
in
just a minute ago. So I thought this was a great segue to talk about this. So
absolutely. Just let's bring her on.
Let's put her on. Okay. Lola, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Yes, great. Thank you very much for having me. Dr.
Lyle,
I'm so impressed by your understanding about humor and psychology. I love listening to you. You're such an interesting person to listen to.
Interesting is an interesting word.
you bring a lot of insight, so I really appreciate you taking the time and being on the show. I also listened to your episode on the humor and psychology, and I have a question, and I'll ask my question and I'll listen offline. So my quick question is, I do work with boards, and I'm trying to help them to be more effective. One of the things that I find interesting is when they get all emotionally charged, they lose the effectiveness. And so I'm trying to talk to them how it is important to understand and tune into your emotions. And as I was listening and I was thinking how to make this more funny, because, you know, it's very difficult for them to take it. So I was hoping maybe you can shed some light on how to do that more effectively, on using emotions and maybe making some fun about emotions in the boardroom.
Yeah.
And I'll take your answer offline. Thank you so much.
Very good. Okay. So as I get this question, what she's asking is, she actually does some consulting with apparently board of directors of companies. And so they bring her in to try to help them be more effective. And it turns out that when they get emotionally charged, they lose their effectiveness in principle. So that's sort of the notion. So there are some suppositions there that that when you get emotional, you are potentially less effective. And we could ask sort of why we think so, because that wouldn't necessarily be the case. I would say that maybe perhaps the board, if they get emotionally charged, it would sound like probably the board it wouldn't get so much charged against outside members attacking it. It would probably become less effective, as there are squabbles within the board, and the emotions that we're talking about are probably anger, is probably what's happening. So I wish you were still here with us, but I'm going to assume that that's probably the case, because I can't imagine other emotions winding up being particularly destructive. So, for example, the board doesn't get all lusty and start having an orgy and wasting time that way. The board doesn't wind up getting all excited and just start cheering. And the board doesn't.
You're making me think we're back in like Portland or something, or Berkeley.
So I'm thinking that the problematic emotion that she's dealing with is when the board experiences disagreements between members of the board, and there winds up being strife, and so it becomes difficult. And so so what she's going to try to do is help them be more effective at their disagreements when that's happening. And so this is now comes under the issues of conflict resolution and how it is that we go about doing conflict resolution. The and there are strategies that I would suggest. I think I've actually done shows on these strategies. These are things that I do with couples, a whole strategy that I call crystal clear, that we do some flooding of the circuit before we confront people. And we also understand that anger is a mechanism that is activated naturally in people when they feel like they're being treated unfairly. So it's important that we keep circling around to the concept that we want to be fair. And that that winds up being a central concept that takes place. It's also true that I haven't seen this discussed elsewhere, but it's been my observation that when people get into arguments, first of all, when they get into arguments, they are it is no longer a discussion; it's an argument. And what makes it an argument is that people, one or more people, feels like they are not getting enough status, and so this is now they start the esteem dynamic shifts to one where we are attacking the other person's status because they're attacking our status, and it develops what I call a vicious cycle, and that's a problem. The another aspect of the vicious cycle is that. That I believe that the argument instincts of humans are designed by nature to be super rapid. The human being was designed with specialized circuits to look for weaknesses in the other person's argument and to essentially attack them as aggressively as possible and as quickly as possible, even in a distorted manner in terms of what their argument is, in order to quickly gain favor of listeners. Because I believe that in the Stone Age, the listeners were not that interested in your disputes, and they were only vaguely interested. And so if you were able to win their favor, the ballast of the argument would go against the losing party. And so you would then gain the advantage in the disagreement. So I believe that there's actually quite a bit about human nature that makes arguments contentious. In other words, makes disagreements contentious as they move into arguments, we wind up generating vicious cycles. We wind up with argumentative instincts activated, and the desire is to win and to get dominance rather than to actually listen to what the other person has to say and figure out just how far apart our positions really differ and whether or not the other person has anything interesting or of merit that I need to add to my position. People really aren't designed to do that very well. And so I'm sure that a lot of boards of directors essentially follow their instincts right into all of these traps and then wind up in inevitable messes. So that being the backdrop, I would use my standard technique for coaching human beings about human beings is to use cartoon-like kinds of scenarios, and often I will use them with animals. So I will, I might have pictures of, Peter Rabbit and somebody else, and Daffy Duck, and I'm going to have kind of situations. I'll draw these things myself. And extremely poorly by design. Not that I could draw them any better if I wanted to. But the point is I draw out my little pictures when I give presentations. And if you haven't seen
phenomenal.
That, then it's worth going online and seeing how I do this and copying it. Everybody's free to use the same technique. The point is that when we use a third party, even another species, that we're anthropomorphizing, and it's better to use another species than it is ourselves. The reason why that's true is that it gives a significant distance to the dynamics. And so people feel like we're not pointing at anybody in the room. Whereas if you used a real life person, you said, well, Bill's the kind of guy that does such and such, or such and such, and they argue about this, and you know, what a ridiculous thing Bill said, and he's the kind of person that, you know, you could potentially make those things funny. But it's a lot easier to do it if you do it with animals. So when I talk about weight loss, I talk my weight loss talk called Losing Weight Without Losing Your Mind. I am essentially talking through the issues that human beings have with weight loss, but I talk about chickens and I talk about my cats. In other words, I'm out there talking about other creatures. And so I'm doing that in a way then that people can absorb the lesson, but it's way muted in terms of its how personal it gets to them. So these are the kinds of things I would do. And I would look for, absurd situations of any kind. I would certainly be looking for ways to make some of these lessons funny. I'm always on the lookout for funny situations, and I'll write them down. I've got a list of them somewhere where I will use them in my discussions because there's, you know, often something interesting and an important tale to be told. With respect to something that is funny that happens to you, or actually, anytime I get embarrassed, I'm happy about it because it means it's a story I'm going to tell, and so the more embarrassed I am, the better it is. So something goofy happens to me that I make a fool out of myself by accident. Believe me, you're going to hear that in my lectures. For the next 10 years. And so this, anything that also, so obviously Lola or anybody else listening, another thing that you want to do is you want to think back on any ways where you have done these things badly wrong. And we're not going to say, oh, and then now I'm so smart I do it differently. Okay? No, we're going to actually just leave it right there about how you did it like an idiot. And then we're going to talk about, Dick the Duck. That's not a good name. With somebody else. And,
there you go. You can remember working. The story for the next 10 years.
Yeah, I'm talking to 1,000 people in live listening, and this is what I come up with. So anyway, so don't try to do it off the cuff. You're going to hang yourself. That's a good lesson. So anyway, the bottom line is we come up with these things. We draw our funny little pictures, we tell our little stories, and this is probably the best way. And what we can do is we can weave in and out between the stories, and what I do is I weave in and out between entertaining little animal stories, and then I weave right into something that's core to human nature. And so this way they can tolerate a direct lecture for a few minutes about something important, and then we weave our way out of it. So we don't try to overwhelm them. We move in and out of this sort of thing, and we try to get this, these points across. But the main points, it's important that the core message be talking right to the source code. And the source code here that I would share with you, it's important, is argumentative instincts, natural desire to win, the quick nature of trying to get on top of a dominance hierarchy, and defeat the other party who is not seeing the merit in what it is that you have to say, and in fact that the best solution comes with plenty of patience, hearing people out, feeding back to them what it is that you think that they said to the point where it's crystal clear. Okay, this is how we do it. So we cannot be under time pressure when we are trying to resolve something. Unfortunately, if you've got some blowhard on a board who you can't shut up, then you've got a dysfunctional board, and that's the problem. All right, let's move on.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay.
Okay, so our next question. Okay. Dear Dr. Lyle, I recently found your show and love it. I've been binge listening. Oh, that's nice. Okay. You should get on Netflix, yeah. Okay. I have a couple questions. If a potentially miscalibrated man is dating down but enjoying their relationship is it common for him to lower himself to the level of the female in terms of ambition and motivation to try and find an equilibrium within the pair bond? If so, how common is it for the female to try and prevent a male from regaining any lost ambition and motivation in such a scenario?
Yeah, that's actually sort of very clever. It's very interesting. And there's a lot of suppositions there that walk us down that road. For example, potentially miscalibrated male is dating down. Well, if he's miscalibrated, he doesn't know he's dating down. Okay, so there we go. So right away, some of the suppositions that follow are not going to follow. So here's what it is that we find. There are men that are willing to date.
I just have to say, I really like how you just get straight to the heart of the issue. God knows all the dumb questions I've asked you, and it's just like, you know, right to the core.
All right. It's actually, there's a lot in this question that's excellent. So let's walk down through something that we know that I think is interesting if people haven't heard it before. And that is that usually it's very unlikely for people to be miscalibrated on the low side. Almost everybody is miscalibrated on the high side. That is human nature. In other words, so human nature is built with enough narcissism in it and it's built that way for a reason. And the reason is it's no good to leave genetic chips on the table. So people are ferocious negotiators when it comes to their genetic chips, and their love mechanisms are just not going to fire up unless it feels like it's one hell of a deal. That's just how it works. Now, sitting next to this is the fact that males' levels of commitment in a relationship run a gamut that it's actually a continuum, but we think of it, or when we speak of it, we think of it in categorical terms as what I'm going to call pair bond or casual mating strategy. So we can see clear evidences of these two things, where some guy's crazy about a girl, wants to marry her, sticks with her for years and years and years, and just thinks she's the greatest thing. Okay, well, that's clearly what we're going to call pair bond. And casual mating is, you know, the guy's had a couple of beers, and it's getting late near closing time, and there's sort of something that's halfway interesting that seems to be sidling up to him, and he doesn't remember her name, but he's willing to knock it over, you know, and then lose the phone number quickly and get lost the next morning. All right, that's casual mating strategy. And, of course, there are things, relationships in between. But it's going to turn out that pretty quickly relationships start to reveal themselves as to whether or not they are pair bond oriented or casual mating strategy oriented. So in this scenario, this guy is suggesting that this guy feels essentially he's in a pair bond situation. He's not planning to go anywhere. That means that he's not thinking that he is that he's trading down. Now, I can tell you this, that we do have evidence that there are men who are willing to trade down into pair bonds. It's not typical, but it does happen. And when it does happen, when men know that they are more sexually attractive than their mates, we find something astonishing taking place. And that is that what we find, if you put a clock on the amount of direct childcare that takes place in relationships, it turns out that men typically, in a standard pair bond situation, that where the men are equal or not as attractive as the female is by objective observers, which is quite typical, then it's going to turn out that men do 10% of the direct childcare. Now, that doesn't mean they're doing 10% of the lifting in the family. They're working more hours at work, et cetera, et cetera, and they may be doing other things as well. But the point is that when it comes to the actual changing of the diapers and the actual, you know, wiping of the muck off the kid's face, that the that is what the average male does, is 10% of the direct time. It's going to turn out that when those males are objectively more attractive than their spouses, the amount of direct child care is 1%, which is absolutely incredible. So there's a factor of 10 difference in the amount of time that this guy will spend. Now, I have to tell you, I have seen situations like this in my practice, and the only situations that have ever come to mind, not only do they fit this pattern, but the males, of which there's probably been about 5 where this was very clear to me and clear to everybody else, where the male was considerably more attractive than the female. In every case, these males were lazy as hell. Okay, the females worked very hard. They had jobs. They hustled. They often made more money than the guy. And the guy was just not willing to push very hard about anything. And so this is telling us that they are, in fact, calibrated. They do know what's going on, and they are inherently lazy. So this is there's nothing wrong with this situation. The females are happy to be in the situation, probably somewhat anxious, etc. If a male is only parking there in that relationship for a short while, and he actually has some hustle, and he's going to hustle, then the female absolutely knows that he's planning on leaving in all probability. So I have seen that situation clinically as well. And so that a relationship was under a tremendous amount of strife, where an 8 male was with a 5 female, and that relationship was in trouble because the male had parked there for a little while because it was convenient, and then he was actually moving on, and he was not in fact lazy. He was going to go out and do some major things in the world to get resources to make himself more competitive, and she could see the handwriting on the wall, 100 miles away. So these are the sorts of dynamics that go on, and it shouldn't surprise us at all. But there's nothing in principle wrong with a guy that is happy, feels like everybody's happy in the situation. He doesn't have a lot of ambition. He's relaxed, and he doesn't feel a lot of anxiety about losing his mate. And it's because he's quasi-consciously aware that his mate feels like that she killed the bear in the looks department. And so I would not is it possible that there could be dynamics on her part to have him, to cap his ambition? Possibly, but the truth is he doesn't have a lot of ambition or he wouldn't be there.
Hmm.
All right. Very interesting. Let's move on.
Cool. All right. Next one. Dear Dr. Lyle, I'm 68 years old, but most of the time I feel like I'm 35. Occasionally 17, and once in a great while, I feel like I'm 5. Looking in the mirror can be shocking, or more like a gentle reality check. Is this a function of personality, maybe falling somewhere on one of the big 5 bell curves, or is it a universal something hardwired in our brain?
I'm not exactly sure what he's asking, but I'm going to take a shot at it. Yeah, I'm getting up there, so I know the feeling. So here's the deal, that when we see older people, their faces actually look tired. The wrinkles look tired, etc. So yet some of the things that happen to the face as we age are similar to the effects of what happens when we're younger, but we are in fact badly fatigued, okay? So as a result of this, when we look at older people, it's not uncommon for us to make the inference that they are in fact really tired, okay? Tired and worn out. And so, however, this is not true. So, they might be tired and worn out because maybe they got sleep apnea or maybe the dog keeps them up all night. Who knows? But there's nothing about the mind of a human when it's, you know, 70 years old, if it's well rested, that it isn't just absolutely alert and spry and happy and joyous. And there's no, quote, feeling 70, okay? There isn't. You don't feel any different. I'm in my 50s. I don't feel any different than I did when I was 20. Nothing has changed in terms of how it is that my nervous system feels. Now, what you will feel is you'll feel some things like you might feel some aches and pains. I'm a little stiffer when I get up in the morning and walk than I was when I was 20, I'm sure. And it's also true that your energy when it comes to certain issues is not as great. And it's probably true mentally. I have no doubt that they haven't actually looked at that. I'm sure they have looked at it, but I don't recall anything interesting about that. But what is very true is we know that's true physically. So we know that the organ reserve capacity of your cardiopulmonary system is substantially being reduced, as well as everything else does over time. The endothelial cells inside your cardiovascular system are shrinking in terms of their total size. They start out, you know, the size of two tennis courts when you're a young adult. These are the cells that are going to help, you know, help the entire cardiovascular system work properly. By the time you're 70, you've lost half of that surface area. And so there's just no way that you can be the endurance athlete that you could have been earlier. So if you look at decay function on every single physical variable involved in athletics, you will see a decay function over age that is undeniable and cannot be stopped. So the world's records on all different kinds of activities go through a very predictable graph and slope as human beings sort of go down through the time that they lose organ reserve capacity and other things. So did we look tired? Yeah, we look tired. Are we? No. So the point is that you could look tired and worn out, and when you look in the mirror, it can be a shock because you can be seeing the face of someone who looks tired and wiped out, but they're not tired or wiped out at all. And so that's that I think is a fairly universal experience of a lot of people as they age when they look in the mirror. Now, was there a second part of that question? I forgot.
The second part was that is it part of the personality or is it something hardwired to like look?
Yeah, I think it's hardwired to look at a face and make assumptions about whether it's fatigued. Mm-hmm. And so if it happens to be your own face, you have this, you know, you're not supposed to be looking in a mirror, for God's sakes. So that's a completely unnatural act. So you can look in the mirror and see that you look old and tired. And the truth is you don't feel old or tired, and I think that's a little bit of a shock. So I don't think that's any kind of bizarre personality characteristic. I think that's going to be a universal experience of humans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just someone sent me a picture. There's a 104-year-old guy running a marathon or, you know, running some sort of track meet. And the caption is, he's 104 years old. What's your excuse? And, of course, somebody commented on this picture saying he had more time to train.
That's very good. I don't even want to analyze where the status loss is there, but it's just great. It's just beautiful. All right.
So this is another question from actually one of the people who's called in before.
Okay,
dear Dr. Lyle, do the elderly come up against the same casual mating versus pair bond strategies that the young folks face? The reason she asks this is that pregnancy is no longer an issue, but attaining or preserving resources can be a factor. Since we didn't live nearly this long in the Stone Age, do our unconscious motivations stay in tune with the younger age? In other words, is an elderly woman still protecting her non-existent eggs?
That's a really good question. And I'm going to answer it in the following way, I don't believe anybody has a theory about this that holds any water. This question will have to be settled scientifically. In other words, the only way to answer her question is to actually go get data. The reason why it's I actually believe that it's the answer exactly as she's supposing, which is that the neural circuits do not change. So now I know that some of them change in the sense that that people are aware of the possibility of a thing called grandchildren. And this is a unique characteristic of our species. So no other species is nosing around in its adult children's sexual life and then watching for kin that may come as a result of that and then provisioning those grandchildren and being attached and delighted to that process. So this is clearly a human characteristic that is bizarre. And that being the case, if you can have that, you could also in principle have a situation where it could be smart enough to have some shifts that would take place post-menopause with respect to their sexual dynamics. Now, I don't think so. So I think that men and women are playing exactly the same strategies that are etched in stone. I don't think that there was any evolutionary process to disturb those strategies once they were in place. So I think that, in other words, I just don't think that there is any profit from somehow using sexuality in some way, you know, in a casual mating strategy that would somehow be useful for the organism's survival and reproduction, bluffing the males into thinking we still have eggs and then getting resources out of them and then giving them to our grandchildren and doing them in a opportunistic and flirtatious fashion. Like, God knows what you would come up with, and the answer is it doesn't make any sense. So what makes sense is that that we are endowed with a sexuality that will last, in females' case, past their reproductive years. It makes sense that it would last somewhat past the reproductive years because she should be attempting to bluff a male that, for example, was the father of her last child. Let's suppose she had her last child at 43. We would expect her to be essentially bluffing him into thinking that she would still be able to have children 4 or 5 years later. So he should still be trying to essentially farm that field for a while and hopefully to pop out another kid. That's what his neural circuit should be designed by nature to be lured into that potential trap. And she would be designed by nature to not suddenly know that she doesn't have any eggs left and therefore get out of this game, because the truth is she's got a one-year-old infant, and that one-year-old infant could really use paternal support for a heck of a long time, okay? So as a result, you would expect the female to be engineered to bluff the male into continuing to pour resources into her, and you would expect that the male would have countervailing evolutionary pressures that would make him increasingly sensitive about aging cues. Now, we know that this is true. We know that males are actually twice as sensitive to aging cues in the face than are females in terms of their sensitivity to aging cues in males. So males, in the same way that females have are twice as sensitive in terms of their sense of smell, there would be many reasons for that. And one of those reasons would be that because they more heavily invest in offspring, they need to smell males to actually determine the nature of their immune chemistry in order to pick mates more accurately in terms of immune chemistry that matches their own, so the children wind up with good immune systems. So there's probably other reasons as well why the female knows, probably much more involved in cooking, and therefore they need to be much more sensitive to the possibility of bacterial contamination, et cetera. So I'm not sure all of the reasons why females might have such a much better nose, but males have much better acuity and sensitivity to wrinkles on the female face, we see the worldwide panic and fascination on the part of females with keep getting wrinkles off their face. The cosmetics industry, plastic surgery, et cetera, et cetera. This is massive business. This is a $1 trillion industry, and there's a damn good reason for it, okay? Because the females know that the males are watching those characteristics like hawks, and that their cachet is dropping dramatically with every tiny little wrinkle that happens. I mean, it's a hell of a thing to say, but it is exactly what's transpiring. And so this is what the female would be designed to do would be to be silly, youthful, have youthful movements, toss her head, and et cetera. In other words, to exude youthful cues even into her middle years and later years. This could potentially bluff males into sticking around and thinking that there's still some eggs to harvest. And so once you have that situation, there would be no reason to sort of temper that machinery once it's been selected by evolution. And so at what point do you stop bluffing? At 52? At 62? The answer would be, if you're going to bluff, you just keep bluffing it all the way up. And so I believe that this is a hardwired and constant feature of human nature, and I believe that elderly women will, quote, be guarding the eggs and not wanting to, quote, give it up early and, quote, not be disrespected. And the males will be pushing for quicker sexual access as much as they can. And we will have the very same dynamics that we see in 20-year-olds.
Hmm.
It'll just be slower. So that's how it goes. It's not quite as noisy.
I'll burn that bridge when I get to it.
You got it.
All right. Okay, next question. Dear Dr. Lyle, I have a question about racism with regards to genetics. Well, this is going to be an interesting. All right. So if this is a topic you've already covered, I apologize, but I'm curious to know whether being racist is part of our genetic code as humans. If I think about it in relation to caveman times, I can see how thinking you're superior to someone else may have a benefit to your genetic survival. On the other hand, when I think of young kids, it seems pretty clear that they really don't see differences in people with regard to race, ethnicity, disability, etc. They truly seem colorblind. So my question is, are we born racist or do we learn it?
Very good question. First of all, if we were to look back on human natural history, there would be no point in any kind of anything that would remotely resemble the racial puzzles that people are posed with today. And the reason is that everybody looks just like you. So people never would have encountered people that looked substantially different than them. The typical human being would live their whole lives within a 25-mile roaming range, and so they would never run into anybody that looked at all different than them. So maybe slightly different, given gene pool on the other side of the mountain that you've been relatively secluded from for 75 years, three or four generations, you might be seeing obviously slight differences in facial configurations, very, very slight, so you sort of know that that's one of the Joneses from the other valley. And so when you meet somebody on the road, you're like, oh, well, you're one of the Joneses, I can sort of tell, okay? The nose is a little wide or the ears are a little cupped or whatever the hell it is that happens to be going on over there. So but races, no way. Yeah. So racism as we know it and we see it and we're confronted with it today is a totally modern, unnatural phenomenon that would never have taken place. So now we look at a different question. So what do we see in racism? We see the elements of racism that are interesting and important for us to recognize. Are this issue, as this individual is talking about, of superiority, inferiority is one dimension. And another dimension, though, and the most fundamental dimension to this is going to be what we're going to call in-group, out-group. So the question is, do human beings have natural neural circuits that delineates human beings as in-group, out-group, and then delineates their in-group as better and the out-group as worse? And the answer to that is yes, we do have such instincts. They were first and most clearly discovered by a social psychologist by the name of Henry Tafel, T-A-J-F-E-L. He was in England. I don't know what university he was at. This was we're going back a long ways now in my education. I think this Tafel was writing in the 1960s. It might have been the 1970s, but I have a feeling it was the 1960s. So anyway, he did a series of experiments that became known as minimal groups. And so and the question was, how much data did you have to give a group of people that you were assigning them to two different groups? How much data did you have to give to them before they started acting in a way where they favored their group and disfavored the outgroup? And the answer was very interesting. He found that it was the minimal amount of information that was necessary to delineate two groups was enough to start demonstrating an in-group, out-group effect. So let me give you an example. I actually forget how it is that Tafel did his work. But let me give you an example of how this could transpire. So suppose that you and I were in a room, Nate, and there was like about 18 people in the room, and we were going to people were going to draw pictures of, I don't know, a bunch of flowers, okay? So this is what they were going to do, and we're going to do this over the next 20 minutes, and everybody's going to draw their little flowers, and everybody's got their little pastels out there and their chalk. And what we do is when we walk in the room, if you're the teacher, you say, okay, well, we're going to be drawing these things. And, let's see. Now, the people here, and if you took your hand in that room and you sort of drew an imaginary line down the middle of the room, and you say, okay, well, the people on this half of the room, and you wave your hand at the half of the nine people on that side. And then that's all you did. You say, no, forget it. We're not going to do that. And you completely ignore it. But what has happened in the mind of every single person in that room is that you have divided the room into two groups. Okay? So it's in their minds, oh, I'm kind of a member of the people. These are the people that are on that side of the line. I'm in that group. And the people on the other side are like, no, we're in that group. That was the minimal amount of information necessary to indicate that there was a delineation. Then we have everybody draw their little paintings. And then we have, people go up one by one and put their painting on the board, and then everybody rates that painting from 1 to 10, quietly and privately. When we turn those scores in, we will find an absolute in-group, out-group effect. The people on the left side of the room will rate their artists better than they will rate the artists on the right, and vice versa. Okay, so Tafel showed this over and again, as I recall. And in a variety of contexts. And so this tells us that there is a deep automatic neural circuit designed in people to say, which group am I in, what is our group, and our people need to be treated better than the other people. And if you're going to treat the other people, if you're going to treat your people better than the other people, then you're going to need neural mechanisms that are going to be needing to somehow justify it, or you wouldn't have to, but you could. It would be an easy trick to have neural circuits that would justify this, and so you would justify it that they're somehow objectively superior. Okay, so I think that this, Henry Tafel and his work essentially outlines a discovery of the quote racist, and it's not racist; it's in-group, out-group, superior. Inferior circuit. Race just happens to be a way that we could do it. We could the minimal amount of information is necessary to fire this up, and so racism has other things going on because there are objective differences between races, and so those things are also fueling some of the way that people think and feel about things. But even if there weren't, if they were, if the race, if all races of man were actually identical except for some arbitrary differences like skin tone, if they were otherwise identical, we would still likely see, quote, racist action in the human mind behind the fact that the minimal group mechanisms existed for Stone Age hunter-gatherers that were looking for any indication of what is who is in and who is out, and then treating people accordingly.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting. Interesting. So.
All right.
Yeah, that's a very charged question, and I'm glad you were able to answer it without, you know, well, you know.
Yeah. Without all hell breaking loose.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Well, I think we're going to call it a show and get to the
good.
Other questions. Thank you guys for all the questions. We will get to the rest of the questions on another day. We got some really interesting questions from a guy named Dave, from a couple of other listeners. So we'll get to them next time, maybe a couple of shows from now. And coming up, Dr. Lyle, we have you had an on-air session with one of our listeners that we're gonna be showing in a couple of weeks. So keep stay tuned for that, where you talk a little bit more. This listener, she had an issue with her father. They were constantly arguing. So you helped her through that. So really appreciate that. That's going to be coming up in a couple of weeks.
Terrific.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Lyle,
all
have
right,
a wonderful
sir.
Night. We'll talk to you next week.
Very good. We'll see you soon.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.